Every star is a Saturn, and our Saturn is a very ordinary star. We know stars that are many thousands of times brighter than our Sun, millions of times sometimes, and also stars that are much weaker than the Sun. They have different temperatures, different colours, and different distances. They are a very varied lot. And of course they are a very, very long way away. Beyond the Sun, the nearest star is 4 light years away. A light year is the distance travelled by light in 1 year, nearly 6 million miles. So it's quite a way. And the universe is a very big place indeed.
So when we see stars at night, sometimes they look like they're different colours. How come stars are actually different colours? How does that actually happen?
They really are different colours because they're different temperatures. Our Sun is a yellow star. Betelgeuse and Orion is not so hot. Its surface is cooler and therefore red. And Ceres and the Great Dog is hotter and therefore white. So it does go entirely in colour. Orange, red, yellow, blue. And our Sun is an ordinary yellow star. Difference in surface temperature is what makes them different colours.
One of the things, obviously, that we notice, and my 9-year-old niece wanted me to ask you this, is why did the stars actually twinkle?
Star twinkling is purely an effect of the Earth's atmosphere. The starlight comes to us through the Earth's air, which is dirty and unsteady, and shakes the light around. That's what it is. And a star is virtually a point source. A planet doesn't twinkle so much because a planet shows a tiny disk, therefore twinkles less. Now, go up high in an aircraft, you'll find stars don't twinkle much. And go into space, or on the surface of the moon, where there's no air, and the stars don't twinkle at all. It is purely an effect of the Earth's atmosphere, and the lower down the star is, the more atmosphere has to come through, and the greater the twinkling.
Over the years, Patrick, you've been involved with astronomy for a long, long time.
I have indeed.
When did that actually begin? How did you get hooked on astronomy?
I began by reading a book when I was 7 years old. I still got the book. I read it through and I was fascinated, and I went on from there. And that's the advice I give to everybody. Start by doing some reading, look round, go out and learn the night sky, look round with binoculars, and then join a local astronomical society, of which there are plenty. That's what I would recommend.
How did it feel to you then when you began? How did it feel when you first got the stars in your blood?
I was rather overwhelmed, I think, and it really rather take over my life. And I must say, it had always been my main interest. And I was always concerned with it. I always tried to follow up what was happening there and do what I could. And I say, eventually I got some binoculars, then a little telescope, and went on from there. So it's been part of my life, virtually all my life.
What kind of memories have you got then as particular things when you began to really get into looking at our own solar system, for example?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, my interest always was the moon. I got interested in the moon straight away. I looked at it, and of course later on I was on the NASA moon map team, and I was near Mission Control when they actually landed on the moon. It was a great moment. I heard Neil's voice coming through, "The Eagle has landed." That was a tremendous moment.
Actually being there, that must have been incredible to see the television pictures on top of the radio astronomy pictures.
For the first time, we bridged the gap between one world and another. We were actually seeing images from the surface of the moon itself. That opened the space age, really, in the manned exploration. And we'll go on from there. More men have been to the moon. If all goes well, we'll send men to Mars in your lifetime, for not mine. And beyond that, who knows? We won't get to the stars, I think they're too far away, but other planets, yes, and there may be lunar bases, Martian bases, and I wonder what it'll be like up there.
What do you think it would be like? If you had the chance, would you go?
I'd love to, but I'm afraid I'm the wrong age, I'm 84. I would love to have gone. On the moon, you have bases, there are scientific bases, obviously, and you can't turn the moon into a second Earth. And life there is going to be very artificial, inside your spacecraft, inside your bases. There's no air, no real protection from radiation, so the moon is not a safe place. On Mars, much further away, there is an atmosphere there, not one we can breathe, but there should be Martian bases too. And looking further ahead, if all goes well, there should be a flourishing civilization upon Mars, but it all depends how we govern ourselves, and we're not doing that very well at the moment.
I know that the human condition is something that you're quite bothered about, Patrick. I don't know if that's because you've looked so far out at the solar system and beyond, but I know that you're quite bothered about the human condition and wonder what we're actually up to here on planet Earth.
I am indeed. For the first time, we've got the scientific know-how to wipe each other out, and we haven't got the civilization not to do it. And it may be, you know, that every civilization gets to that stage and destroys itself. I don't know. I hope we don't go down that road, but it does depend on choosing world leaders. And I must say, looking around the present world leaders inspires me with a feeling of no confidence at all.
What's the solution? Do you think everybody should have a look at the solar system and beyond and think about...
The more you learn about astronomy, the more you realise we're an unimportant race and we have our own Earth to look after, and it's a good world for us. And if we look after it, we can do well, and no one knows what heights we can reach. But, say, if we go the other way, well, we may go back in the Stone Age. I'm hoping it'll be all right. I know one thing. In 50 years from now, the world won't be the same place as it is now. It'll either be much better or much worse. It won't be the same. You'll see it, I won't.
Well, looking back, I saw the 50th anniversary programme of The Sky at Night. It was great.
It was great, wasn't it?
I thought it was excellent. Just looking back at some of those developments that have happened in astronomy have been fantastic. What are some of the highlights for you then, Patrick, outside of the moon landings?
Well, obviously space research has opened a new avenue, but there are other things too. We are now living in the electronic age. I've got my telescope in my garden, a modest 15-inch, so you've seen it. Well, that telescope, with modern equipment, can now take photographs of the planets, for example, far better than any professional observer they could have done when I began The Sky at Night. We are living now in the electronic age. It's revolutionised everything. So that's the great advantage, I think.
So what do you think, then, looking ahead to the next 50 years? Obviously, there's a lot of politics in space exploration. It costs money, and I know that the UK have certainly got a limited budget. There's an EU space programme, a Japanese one, an Indian one.
One thing in mind. 2 weeks of our little adventures in Iraq and Afghanistan would pay for the entire space program for 100 years.
Well, that's a fair comment, Sir Patrick.
I would like to see all our most present political leaders and send the whole lot off on a one-way journey to Alpha Centauri.
I'm not supposed to laugh in this interview. Okay, Sir Patrick, I'll compose myself, right? I like the idea, though.
I don't want to put Mr. President Bush up on Mars. I mean, we don't want to pollute Mars.
So, looking ahead at the next 50 years, what kind of things do you think space exploration can actually achieve in practical terms?
Unmanned space exploration is limitless. Space stations, space telescopes, we're doing marvels there, no question about it. Manned space research depends upon two things. First of all, it's politics. And the second is radiation. There are radiation dangers when you get beyond the Earth's protective screen, and we are not yet sure how bad they are or how to cope with it. And that could be a massive hold-up, because it does depend really on what we're prepared to put into it. And we are now more or less working together. And the Cold War was over until Mr. Bush restarted it, but it is better now than it was. And certainly the International Space Station really is genuinely international.
Well, I've just had a look in the garden at two of your incredible telescopes, I have to say, absolutely beautiful. The mahogany telescope is an absolute beautiful,
15-inch, yes.
Beautiful piece of equipment, I have to say.
It's a good telescope too.
I can imagine, and I'll take you up on the offer of coming back and having a look sometime. In terms of like people at home looking through their own telescopes or binoculars, what kind of things can they look for realistically in the sky?
Amateurs can now do original, valuable research, and they're doing it. Let me give you one example. You know things called supernovae? They are stars that explode and blow up, and they do so without warning. We haven't had one in our galaxy now for a long time, but they occur in other galaxies, millions of light years away, and it's important to get them early and find out what they're doing, and amateurs do that. Tom Bowles, one of our English amateurs, has now discovered over 100 supernovae in external galaxies. So he's making really valuable work.
We talked a little bit there about our own human life here on Earth. And of course, I know you get asked this a million times. What about life on other planets or in other systems? How likely is that, Sir Patrick?
It must be so. Our sun is one of 100,000 million stars in our galaxy. We can see 1,000 million galaxies, that's only part of them. And many of these stars do have planets, we know that. Therefore, the number of worlds where life could appear is endless, I think. One thing we don't know, if there's a world where life can appear, will it? That's what we can't prove yet. There's no proof of life anywhere beyond the Earth. I'm sure it's there. And the key may well be Mars. There are no little green men, no Martians, but if we go through there and find there's any trace of primitive life, that will show that life will appear where it can. And I'm quite sure there are plenty of civilization in the universe. Some about the same as ours, some far better, and some worlds rendered radioactive, where the inhabitants have got to our stage and wiped themselves out. They must all be there. I'm sure there's plenty of life spread through the universe, but I can't yet prove it. But the first glimpse we have of any life elsewhere, that'll be the key. I think it may come from Mars.
It's a fascinating thought, and I think it would change perhaps the way that we think about ourselves and our own origins, perhaps, and our future.
It would not help. Our whole philosophy would be altered. I can say glibly now, I'm sure there's life there, but I can't prove it. When we can, say, our whole philosophy is going to be altered. And it may happen, I think, at any moment. After all, we're looking now for signs of primitive life on Mars. If we find it, that may be the answer. Of course, intelligent life is way out. There's none of that in the solar system, except possibly on the Earth. So the nearest intelligent race is light years away, and we can't get there. They might get to us. I'm no believer in flying saucers. On the other hand, I'm not saying that there may be people who have mastered the art of interstellar travel. It could happen, but there's no proof it's happened yet.
So you don't believe in flying saucers?
I do. I wish I could, but as I say, people say to me, if a flying saucer landed in my garden and a little green man came by, what would I say? I would say, good afternoon, a tea or coffee. Please come with me to the nearest television studio.
One of the great things about being down here, Patrick, is just looking around your library. It's absolutely fantastic. And to see some of the paintings that I think it's your mum did, of actual kind of like E.T. bugs, you call them.
She was marvellous. She had the music and she had the art. I got the music. I did not get the art. If I had one spark of artistic ability, I'd try and develop it. But I am so hopeless that there's no point.
Where did she get some of it? I mean, the one I'm looking at just up there, which I took a photograph of, is kind of like got a palm tree there. It's a really sweet scene. Where did she kind of get her ideas for those scenes from, Sir Patrick?
She did that kind of thing when she was a girl. And she had all these things. They hadn't published them. And when I came along, she said, well, this looked like interplanetary stuff. So she went on from there. And she published her one book when she was 87. I'll give you a copy of it, if you like.
When I visit my friend who lives right on the moors and there's no light pollution and I look up the night sky, I'm just in awe of, you can see the Milky Way actually trailing away. It just gives a little, in words, a little tour of the sky as we look up, what we might see at the moment.
All right, begin then with our own Earth, our own planet going around the sun at a range of 93 million miles. Begin then near at home, the moon, our satellite, 238,000 miles away, a cratered world, no life there yet. Mountains, valleys, craters, a fascinating world. Then beyond that we have the planets of our own solar system. Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn and so on. And they are different worlds. Venus is very brilliant indeed, but not the kind of world we can live. Jupiter and Saturn, they are the gas giants, and Uranus and Neptune too. And then beyond, well, there are occasional visitors like comets. We can't predict them. And there are shooting stars, too. They are little bits of material that dash into the Earth's upper air and burn away. That's where they are. Tiny particles burning away in the Earth's upper atmosphere. Then beyond, we go now millions and millions of miles. And say one light year, nearly 6 million miles. And the nearest star beyond our sun is over 4 light years away. We see those spread across the sky. They are different colours, different shapes, different colours, different brightnesses, different everything, and they make up our own particular galaxy. And then beyond that, you need optical aid here, you'll see other galaxies millions of light years away. So we're looking back into the past. Look at the Andromeda Galaxy, a huge system bigger than ours. It's It's over 2 million light years away. So we are seeing it not as it is, as it was 2 million years ago. And we're looking backwards in time. We can now see out into over 13,000 million light years. And how far can we go? Well, so far as you know, we think the universe began about 13,700 million years ago in a Big Bang. Don't ask me how that happened. Nobody knows. Everything, space, time, matter, came into existence at the same moment. And from there, we can work through. But, of course, the Big Bang itself, we can't. And I've compared that to someone from Alpha Centauri who comes down to Earth and spends an hour in Chelsea High Street. He sees babies, boys, men and old men. He'll work out a baby turns into a boy into a man into an old man. He'll work out the total evolutionary sequence of a human being. But unless someone's told him the facts of life, he won't know how the baby got there. And in cosmology, our baby is the Big Bang. So we answer many questions, but many fundamentals still elude us. Whether we'll solve them, I don't know. After all, our Earth is a long way, very old. We've got several million years yet before anything happens to us, so we've plenty of time to develop. But whether we do or not depends entirely upon ourselves. If we're going to invade space, we must rule the Earth first, and we're not doing very well at the moment.
When you look up at the sky, just with your naked eye, Patrick, or indeed with a telescope, maybe it differs for both, I don't know. What constellations do you sort of look up at and just think, wow, there's Cassiopeia?
Well, what I did when I began, the stars don't move compared with each other, you see. Therefore, you know their positions. And I began with taking a few recognisable constellations, Orion and the Great Bear, and using those as guides to the rest. For example, follow the Great Bear's tail around. You come first of all to Arcturus, then Spica, and so on. And you can do it that way. But it doesn't take that long. I made a pious resolve when I was a boy to learn one new constellation every night. And before long, I had a pretty good working knowledge of the sky. It doesn't take long.
You've put in some incredible research into the solar system particularly, and into the moon, just looking at some of the books that you've actually written and co-authored as well, certainly the ones you've written on your own. What's it been like being involved in so much of that research?
Immensely enjoyable. Every time you find something new, it raises a whole host of new questions, and you go on and on. You meet fascinating people, you do fascinating work, and I've enjoyed it all my life. I began when I was 7, I'm now 84, so I've had a long run.
Well, I'm staggered to see your enthusiasm is exactly as it's always been. Even when I was a kid, and I would watch the sky at night, yes. and see you, and your enthusiasm is as it ever was. It's fantastic.
It was quite genuine, too. Genuinely enthusiastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Having been with you for the last couple of hours, it's incredible to actually come here and see your own telescopes and this incredible library of amazing data, really, and books that you've collected over the years. But in your lifetime, Patrick, I know that you were actually involved with the RAF. Is that correct? How did that come about?
I was an all-time flyer. When I was 60, the war broke out, and didn't want to stay at home, obviously, so I decided I'd better fly. So I did, but only during wartime. I'm only a wartime flyer.
Is it actually true that you fibbed your way into the RAF a little bit?
I'm bound to say, I was a little economical with the truth, both my age and my medical grade. I'm bound to admit that, however, to say, it was a long time ago.
One of the things that happened to you is, didn't you end up in New York and met someone quite famous over that way, am I correct?
You're quite right there. Einstein. I met Einstein, and I'm honoured to do so. And he was exactly what I'd expected. Charming, courteous, unworldly, and rather interesting thing. As you know, he was an expert violinist. He'd been playing his violin, so I said, well, you've done it for violin. He said, oh, I played the Swans, no accompanist. There was a piano there, and I knew it. So I accompanied Einstein. Oh, for a tape, because there weren't any tapes in 1940.
I don't think there's many people could say they've done that.
I'm sure they can't. Very few. And very few who, like me, have met the first airman, the first spaceman, the first man on the moon. So my memory goes back a long way.